Today is a special day where we emphasize the theme of standing on the side of love. And to explain that a bit further, I've asked Peter, one of our church members, to share with you a bit. Good morning. I'm Peter Langlois, the current chair of Interweave at First UU. Interweave is the Unitarian Universalist organization for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered folks and their allies and friends. Tomorrow, February 14th, is the second annual National Standing on the Side of Love Day. On that day and the day surrounding, we reimagine Valentine's Day as a holiday of love and acceptance for everyone. It is an opportunity to honor those whose words and deeds exemplify the values of inclusion, diversity, community, and equality. Excuse me. So, during our service today, Interweave, together with the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, is honoring two Austinites who have worked hard for equality for LGBT people. They are retired Brigadier General Virgil Richard, whose efforts have helped repeal the United States military policy, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and Mr. Paul Scott, who for the past several years has led Equality Texas, the LGBT political and advocacy organization in Texas.
We gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice.
Our testimonial today is given by Virgil Richard. Virgil is a retired Army general who served 32 years of active military service. He is the recipient of the Army Distinguished Service Medal, the Bronze Star, and the Legion of Merit, and many other military honors. Virgil became an outspoken critic of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy of the U.S. Armed Forces and gained national media attention as a part of a small group of high-ranking military officers who have come out as gay after retirement. Richard currently lives in Austin, Texas, with his partner David Potter. Please join me in welcoming our special speaker for our testimony.
It was in May of 2002 when I was on the stage the first time at a Capital City Men's Chorus concert, in which I was asked to share my experience being a gay man in the military service and in the closet the whole time. That was very traumatic for me. I had not come out, but I did it. Shortly after that, the executive director of the Service Members Legal Defense Network asked me to join that organization. And I did that, too, and I still had not come out. But in December of 2003, myself and two other flag officers publicly appeared in the New York Times and declared that we were gay and that the law needed to be repealed after 10 years of being in place. That began the campaign that resulted in the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell law this last December. We did many things to make that happen. We had annual lobby days in which 200 or more men and women from across the country went to Washington, D.C. and called on congressmen and senators' offices. We did this annually, keeping the issue in front of them and making them confront their own beliefs about the subject. In May of 2000, or March of 2005, the first bill to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell was introduced into the House of Representatives in Washington. I happened to be there that day when that was done, along with the other flag officers that came out with me, and some others as well. We had 39 co-sponsors at that point, far short of what was necessary to repeal the law, which is 218 votes in the House. We did other things during this interim period. About 4 years ago, we organized what was called the Forum, which was a group of chaplains, which was organized by Chaplain Paul Dodd, who sits in the second row here behind me. And there's about 30-some chaplains that were part of this that were used to be on active duty, who believed that the law should be repealed, and they were not all gay and they were not all straight, but they had one common purpose, and that was to address the issues that were dealt with in 1993 when the original law was passed overturning President Clinton's desire to let gays and lesbians serve openly in the military service. The Forum has addressed all of the issues that were raised at that point in time, and they made that information available to all of the congressmen and senators in Washington, D.C. We also had people who worked with the Pentagon Working Group, the study that was done the last year about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the views of service members and women on that subject. Fortunately, the working group adopted many of the strategies that we advocated, which was kind of surprising, but they did it. We had one member of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, a female, who was a Navy captain, who had a private meeting with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen. It lasted several hours. But as a result of that meeting, Admiral Mullen became one of the advocates for repeal, along with Secretary Gates. We also invested a lot of effort in getting the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was implemented, General Charlie Kashvili, to come out publicly and say it was time to repeal the law. That was a significant win for our effort. We this last year were successful in getting repeal included in the Defense Authorization Bill, which is a must-pass legislation. It was voted on twice. In the House it was voted on, and we got 245 votes, way more than what we anticipated, and more than was needed to repeal the law. But the Senate was another issue, and we had a friend and the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Carl Levin, who was on our side has been for many years. But he got the issue amended and included in the Senate's Defense Authorization Act, and then it was voted down twice. We lost by a few votes, like two or three each of the votes. We come December in the lame duck session, and we somehow figured out that if we could get this bill separated from the Defense Authorization Act and voted on it as a standalone bill, that we might be successful, and we could bypass some of the opposition that we had, which included Senator McCain, who was going to filibuster it, and we had to have 60 votes in the Senate to be able to avoid that filibuster. We didn't have enough Democratic votes to make that happen, so we had to be sure we got some Republican votes. And we targeted about 10 Republican senators, of which about six of them came across the aisle and voted for repeal. And we were successful in getting the repeal law passed. It's been 9 long years since the effort began. Service members as of today can still not come out and be open about who they are. There has to be a certification by the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the President that implementing the law will not harm readiness, morale, discipline, all those good things. We think that certification will probably happen before May or June The training in the meantime is taking place with general officers and commanders, with chaplains and legal people, and then the rest of the force will be trained about the standards of conduct and the rules of the service members will be expected to conduct themselves by. Once that's done, certification can take place. We wait 60 days, and the law then goes into effect. And men and women can openly serve if they choose to do so, to do it that way. And those who were kicked out before because of the law will have the opportunity to apply and come back in the service if they are otherwise qualified to come at the same rank or grade that they left. That will be a very welcome day in my heart. It was my love for 10 years, and I devoted a lot of time and effort to it, as has Paul and many others here in the Austin area as well as every place else. You should know that Lloyd Doggett and Ron Paul were the only two congressmen in this area of Texas who voted for repeal. All the others, including your senators, voted against repeal. You need to know that. we also had this many other organizations that supported us, including the Unitarian Church as a denomination that was supportive of the repeal. Attica Circle, Democracy for America, ACT Blue, Courage Campaign, Iran and Iraq War Veterans. I mean, I'm not Iran, but Iraq and Afghanistan War Veterans. The Human Rights Campaign came on this last year and supported the repeal. And Service Members United and a lot of other groups helped us do this. There's still a mission to be performed by SLDN. There's many things that can go wrong, and we will be there to make sure that they go right. And that this will be a victory for gay and lesbian service members, and I hope spreads to other actions in our nation. Thank you very much.
Paul Scott is a native of Jackson, Mississippi. He has served as the Executive Director of Equality Texas and Equality Texas Foundation from 2006 to 2010. Paul joined the AIDS Service of Austin in March 2010 as Executive Director. He also serves on the Executive Committee for One Voice Central Texas, an advocacy group for over 40 Central Texas Health and Human Services nonprofits. Would you join me in welcoming Paul Scott?
Thank you, Ed, and members of the congregation. And specifically, I'd like to thank Peter Langlois for this honor of being invited here today. When Peter first contacted me, I was, of course, flattered, but I also was reluctant to come. My reluctance was because I feared being recognized for work that is not yet finished, and for only a small part that I have played in working for equality for people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered. But I reminded myself that it's because of the small part that each of us play in our families, our congregations, and our community that collectively we can create change, and we alter the concepts of what are considered normal societal constructs. Early in my nonprofit career, when I was a peer case manager for HIV-positive individuals, I received some very sage advice from a coworker. Concerned that I was initially taking on too much emotionally, she told me that I could not change the world alone. I could only take responsibility for my change and how it affected people around me. This is what I'd like to talk with you today about, how our changing or being changed can make a meaningful impact on others in our journey standing on the side of love. The first awareness of this concept I had was when I was a child. Framed on our kitchen wall was a quote of unknown origin that my mother lived by. I would hate to have lived without disturbing anyone. I have to say that in her 75 years, she has embraced that philosophy wholeheartedly and has imparted that to each of the four children in our family. Without disturbing people's concepts or challenging the foundation of their fears, we cannot create change. And when I speak of disturbance, I'm not speaking of arguing with someone, but of taking the opportunities, whether small, unknown, or by happenstance, to alter how someone thinks and how they perceive others. How many of us avail ourselves of the opportunity to challenge racially or sexually charged jokes? How many of us take the opportunity to acknowledge that person in the elevator next to us or pay a compliment to the cashier at the grocery store? Personally, I started out as a very reluctant advocate to speak out for equality, reluctant to take risk, reluctant to advocate for myself and others. My reluctance was based in fear of challenging what was considered the norms around me and stepping outside my comfort zone. I also feared I would be ineffective in making a difference. One of my first opportunities to advocate for LGBT equality was when I was firmly entrenched in my own closet. In college, I was chair of Emory University's Committee to Charter Student Organizations. Of course, what would happen during my tenure? The first gay and lesbian organization would apply for their charter. As I said, I was thinking straight and still in the closet. Though I was on a fairly liberal campus, the campus erupted into controversy with protests against chartering the organization and using student fees to support them. Despite the pressure from students and from administration alike, my co-chair and I never hesitated in our decision. We pushed forward with chartering of the organization because it was just the right thing to do. And for me, it was a critical step to move outside of my internalized fear. Several years later, after graduating from law school and joining a litigation firm in Chattanooga, Tennessee, my progression from a reluctant advocate to a forced advocate began. Having worked at the firm for a little under a year, I found out that I was HIV positive. I worked for nearly 4 years to hide both my HIV status and my sexuality, for fear of losing everything I had worked so hard for. I remember one day when I had to cover a workers' compensation deposition for a partner. He told me that the worker had a back injury, but wanted to caution me that the plaintiff was HIV positive and for me not to shake his hand. Of course, here I am, sitting next to the partner, and he's totally aware that I'm HIV positive and that by that time I've been diagnosed with AIDS. Needless to say, not only did I shake the client's hand, but I spent the bulk of that deposition asking him about his HIV medical care and suggesting to him his various options he had for additional care. Though closeted about my status, I was not going to pass up the opportunity to help him in some way. I moved from being a forced advocate to a willing one shortly thereafter when I was outed at my law firm and took disability due to my AIDS diagnosis. It was at this point that I began publicly speaking about my being HIV positive and being gay in conservative Chattanooga. Having come out and spoken about my HIV status in the community, I realized that I was not alone. Not only did my friends support me in many ways and love me in many, many ways, but in turn, they also became advocates. That bigoted partner in the law firm that cautioned me about shaking the HIV positive client's hand and who was also instrumental in trying to get me fired from the law firm. Well, a few years later, after my recovery, he came up to me in the gym, shook my hand, and asked me how my medications were doing and how I was doing. We had never spoken after I left the law firm, but because he knew me and because I had spoken publicly about my life and experiences, his perceptions had fundamentally changed. It is a simple act of living our lives openly or in support of others that can not only disturb, but also change perceptions. It is the simplicity of our being a good neighbor by bringing in a trash can in the cold that can alter our neighbor's understanding of who we are. The opportunity to open the door to dialogue and identification of common values that we share with each other. A few years ago, the actress Sharon Stone spoke at the Black Tie Dinner in Dallas, benefiting the Human Rights Campaign and local LGBT organizations. In her remarks about equality for LGBT persons, she referenced the broader aspiration of treating each other equally and with human dignity. The simple act of taking in a grocery cart from the parking lot for someone else to use, the opening of the door for someone with their hands full, the unexpected compliment to the person in the elevator. Each of these actions, a fundamental opportunity to change the perceptions and to make a connection with another. Our common values of dignity, respect, fairness, and opportunity form the foundation cornerstones of equality for each one of us, regardless of our sexual orientation and gender identity. I know that most of us here, if not all of you in the congregation, hold these values and believe in full equality. But believing is just a small part of making that equality a reality. Each day, we must challenge our perceptions of what we think equality is and how we change our own behaviors. Having been an advocate for people with HIV and AIDS and LGBT persons and their families, I have had to review my own beliefs and step outside myself to realize that I have much room for growth and continue to do so. I was fully unaware of the horrific discrimination of transgender people in our community. The systemic harassment of people who express their gender identity differently has meant socioeconomic discrimination, physical abuse, and even death. Our own Jennifer Gale was unable to find shelter on a freezing cold night in Austin and died just because she was transgendered. I have had the privilege through my work at the Resource Center of Dallas and Equality Texas to gain a better understanding of the complexities of gender identity and the beautiful nature of so many of our fellow Austinites who bravely live their lives despite the misunderstanding and discrimination within our community. Before my first legislative session as Executive Director of Equality Texas, I called a meeting of transgender leaders from across the state to hear what the community need was around gender identity and expression and how to utilize their advocacy skills during our lobby day. I called the meeting and I was completely unaware of any history between the gay community and the transgender community. Sometimes ignorance is bliss. I found out at that meeting that the transgender community had actually protested against Equality Texas at their previous lobby days because they never had been invited. My invitation was a simple request that I thought was the right thing to do. As a result, the transgender community fully supported our legislative agenda. Additionally, their role during lobby day served not only to educate the legislators, but was a powerful opportunity to educate fellow gay, lesbian, and straight allies that participated. I have also had to turn my eyes inward to understand the innate benefit that I have received from white privilege. That just because of the color of my skin, regardless of my background or even my sexual orientation, that I have had a leg up in this world claiming opportunities. I have recognized that those who callously say that someone can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and make something of themselves means nothing to the person who does not have boots and does not have bootstraps. I have also learned that I cannot expect someone to come to my table to support my cause if I have not made an effort to join their table and support their cause. It is these questions we ask of ourselves and the people around us that transform what we think we believe to a more holistic view of our belief systems. In turn, our expansive beliefs become truly representative of the concept of equality. And as we gain a greater understanding of what equality means, it becomes easier to advocate with integrity when we hear that office joke or when someone calls us by a disparaging name. As we honor and celebrate the lives of the people that we know that are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, poor, old, young, whoever it may be, we are also better able to speak up for them. In our family, we have had many years to discuss the impact of what being gay has meant. Not only because I am gay and HIV positive, but also because my two older brothers are gay. The journey was difficult for my parents and for my sister, the token straight sibling. Her name is actually Gayden, too. I'm not joking. But it has been a journey of enlightenment within the family and transformative in how they, in turn, have a better understanding of the beauty of our differences. Several years ago, my niece was a junior at First Baptist High School in Dallas. She was walking with a friend to class who jokingly said about a guy, "He is so gay." My niece, knowing she had three gay uncles, turned to her and immediately said, "What do you mean by that? Why are you saying that?" She challenged her friend to think about what she was saying and to own the consequences of her speech and her beliefs. As for my parents, their journey took them from bitterness and anger to one of love and support for their sons. My parents founded a group in Mississippi advocating to the legislature for increased financial support for HIV medications. My mom, the one who would hate to have lived without disturbing anyone, went to the Methodist Seminary at the age of 63 and became a minister with the goal of opening up a gay church. Our daily dialogue with those around us make a difference. Having a dialogue doesn't mean changing someone's mind. It is a conversation, an opportunity to share and identify those values we have in common. Until we are able to have that conversation, find the common values, we will not be able to make the change that is necessary to make equality a reality. But the conversation we need to have to advance equality in the workplace, in our community, for our families, and for ourselves is not relegated to the halls of Washington, D.C. and Austin, Texas. It is an expansive outreach to our friends, to key influencers in the community, where we talk about our lives, about how important our work is to us and to the greater community. It is about the personalization of the issues that unite us in our common experiences rather than the differences that separate us. We must reach out beyond ourselves and challenge each of us to ask, what am I doing to make equality happen? What am I asking my neighbor, my church, my co-workers to do to make equality happen? I ask you to remember the great strides we have made and the courage of the brave ones that have endured ridicule, fear, physical injury, and hate to pave for the way for all of us to have a better life in so many respects. We owe it to ourselves and to them to remember that our passion, our commitment, originates from the knowledge that equality is a right that is innate and the denial of such is wrong. I am pretty sure that I've embodied the philosophy that I saw on that kitchen wall at a very young age. It is my hope that my disturbing anyone has disturbed them enough to think differently about equality for LGBT persons, and even better, if it has created a tipping point where they too can speak up and also speak out. It is my hope as well that you will go forth and live, love, disturb, and stand on the side of love. Thank you.
I share with you these words of benediction. We dream of a world without hate, without enemies, without anyone left outside the circle of our caring. With all that we say, with all that we do, may we work to make this dream the reality of our lives. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.